guy that would give the shirt off his back. But a tough guy, and those guys, that's the way they played in those days. That's the way you were brought up to play. You played the game for all it was worth, as hard as you could play. And when it was over, you could look in the mirror and say, I've done the very best I could do. And I got beat, so be it. I'm going out there again tomorrow and do the same thing. And I'm sure that guys have a tough time if they look in the mirror, just other than at their hair, to say their conscience is not, the ego gets in the way, I don't know.
There's some fancy coaches named Jimmy Dykes, who's one of your coaches.
Jimmy Dykes.
And Wally Moses.
Wally was okay, but not a great baseball mind by any means. But he was a nice guy. A nice guy to have around. Yes, very good. Uh-huh. Very good hitter. Yeah. For his type of hitting. Uh-huh. You know, he's a spray hitter, what we called a Punch and Judy. He didn't hit many home runs, but he was one of them guys that hit that ball and hit a line drive somewhere, and he was a good runner. Oh, he could fly. And even in his 50s and 60s, he could still outrun a lot of the players that were playing at that time in the prime. He was a good athlete. Super. Not a great big guy, but a good athlete and a nice man. He was a nice man.
Jimmy Dykes had quite a baseball mind.
Dykes was great. Now, I never got to know Dykes all that well, but he was a good man. Oh, there's so many. And that, like I say, you could take any one of them and not have a loser in the bunch, because they were all good men, good baseball. Well, if they weren't, they wouldn't have got the job, number one, in those days. It wasn't the buddy-buddy system. It was, can you do it or can't you do it? And some of the great ones that found, like Casey, a greater manager than mine, when he went to the Mets, the first one to tell you, if you ain't got the horses, you can't pull the wagon. And he didn't have the horses with the Mets, and of course they were losers. So does that make him a bad manager? No. That makes it say he had bad ball players. You can't run, hit, and throw for them. They got to do that themselves. But the leader is the guy that can get them all together in jail and get everybody moving in the same direction and do all those things and work at it and take pride in what they're doing and not have outside interests bugging them all the time, but concentrating on that game, on that field. And those are great leaders. And Stengel, of course, he had great players. Like I said, he could have managed the Yankees. Anybody could have managed the Yankees. You and I could have managed the Yankees and become famous for World Series wins and that, because they guys could play. I mean, you got DiMaggio and the Woodlings and the Bowers and what was that first baseman's name? I never can think
Scout?
Of it. Scout Moose. The Moose guy. All those guys were, I played in the minor leagues with and against these guys, and they were all great. They were great ball players, but they're hard working guys. And they got out there and they worked at their job. They didn't, they go out and party sometimes and play hard on and off the field. But they were always 100% and give 100% on that field every day that they walked out there. And that makes the difference in the caliber of baseball you saw then and the caliber of baseball you see today. You see less and less of the great ball player, the great play. You see, once in a while, you see a great play. And a lot of times, you see a lucky play. When back then, it was an everyday thing. You never seen DiMaggio diving for a ball or giving that flip and all that. He was always standing there waiting for the ball. And he said, well, geez, what an easy play. Well, when it started out, it wasn't that easy. But he learned. He got to jump on the ball. He got himself over there, and he got the ball. And he fired it back in there, and that was the difference. Now they try to make everything a sensational catch and try to make the play of the week and get on, I don't know what they get for that, something, I guess. And
well, what was the best play you ever saw? The best, probably, I guess, I mean, a defensive play. What was the best?
The best defensive play I ever seen? I think the best defensive play, just sensational, and I wasn't playing in the game, and I didn't do it, was Granny Hamner. We had the bases loaded, and I believe it was against the Pirates in Old Shide Park. It was a wet, rainy, nasty night. Oh, it was a miserable night to play. But we're out there playing. And the bases are loaded, and the guy hits a line drive back, and I don't know the pitcher. I can't get that focus in my mind exactly who the pitcher was, but I can see it right now. Granny is charging towards second and dives, catches that ball, slides across second base, comes up on his knees, and throws to first and makes a triple play. That, to me, was the greatest play I ever seen. And I said, I bet you a dollar to a donut that he could do that again and again and again should that situation and that play arrive, because That was the kind of ball player he was, and he had a tremendous arm anyway. But he dove and slid in that, caught that ball and slid across that back in second. I could see that so play, and got it. It was up on them knees and fired that ball to first base. And of course, the guy at first, he was just standing there, and it was so wet he couldn't got back anyway. But he was just, well, how did he do that? It was looked like a base hit. But that was probably one of the greatest. And one of the easiest that I made for an out was when Mays caught the best shot I ever hit out there by McGraw's statue.
Was that the oddest play you've ever seen?
That was the worst play for me that ever happened to me. I was counting that home run already. In fact, I figured out an inside the park home run because I was standing on the side of us at second base when he caught the ball. And I know way he's going to get me from second to home and from out there. Because it's, you know, that's about a $10 ride in a cab across that place. But, oh, I made a couple of, I'll tell you about a good, I did make a good play. I did make a good play once. Roger Hornsby, every day in Cincinnati, he'd run me up and down that terrace in left field because in Crosley Field, it's a very tough position to play and you had to practice it or get yourself killed. So every day, 10 o'clock, we're out there, Rocky Bridges, and I'd walk from downtown Cincinnati out to the ballpark, get there about 10, get our shorts on, grab a bucket of balls and our bats go out, and here's Roger sitting in the dugout. He'd be sitting there, can you just kind of look up and laugh, say, hey, you guys late this morning, ain't you? Go out there, and we'd throw to each other, throw little curves and that, you know, we'd take batting practice to each other. Then he'd say, okay, Jim, come on, he'd have that fungo in that bucket of balls, and Rocky would stand on second base. And I'd get out there at the foot of the terrace, and Roger would get behind shortstop, and he'd hit line drives off that wall. And I'd take them over my head and play the carom and fire to second base. We'll show you how that paid off. Chicago Cubs had a left fielder named Hank Sauer. Remember Hank? We called him Abe Lincoln. Because, tall, raw bone, nice man. I had 3 ton of tuna back every season that the fans threw to him. But Hank was a good hitter. He was a good hitter. He hit a lot of home runs. But he hit a ball off in left center field out there in Old Crosley Field, and I went down that terrace. I played that carom, took that ball, and fired it to second base. I didn't even have to look at second. I could have hit second base blindfolded. I'd done it so many times. I gunned that ball in, and Temple caught the ball. And here comes Hank, rallying. He's kind of jogging into second. Got to stand up double for sure. He's the only thing. He turned. He looks up, and here's John. And John says, hey, Hank, look what I got. Showed him the ball. He took his hat and threw it down and kicked the dirt and said, how the hell did you get that ball? And he questioned the other side. He had that ball in his pocket. I learned to play that carom that well. And that particular day, and he hit that ball and I made that play. And I think that was as good a play as I ever made. It tickled me to death. I don't know, such a sensational play. It would be a routine play, really. But to see Hank's face, him coming jogging into second base, I can still see my old raw bone guy coming in there. Knew he had that stand-up double, and John says, look what I got, Hank. And he just went crazy.
You said you stayed, you continued playing ball until 1963?
63, yeah. After my leg started giving me just bunches of trouble, they sent me to Miami, the Phillies did, to run in the surf, and I worked out with that team all spring, and when the Phillies left spring training camp, I stayed down there with the Miami ball club, and it got to be where I was in pretty good shape. So I believe I could play some. Well, we want you to play, but we don't want you to hurt it. We want you to play. So they sent me to Sacramento, California, in the Coast League, and I went out there in this good warm weather, no rain. Doesn't ever rain in the summertime out there at all. Rains all winter, rain in the summer, and went out there and had a good season. I forget what the record, they're in the book, whatever. I don't know, I had 20-some home runs or whatever. And I had like 15 or 17 assists from the outfield and stole, I don't know, 8 or 10 bases. And my leg was feeling good, but I wasn't tired. But it was the greatest schedule that ever was in baseball, and I would love to see it happen again. You'd go, in the Coast League of them days, you'd go to a town. I say, we're at Sacramento, so we go down and play, say, San Diego. We'd go down there and we'd spend a week there. We'd arrive on Monday. Mondays were always off days. You'd play Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday afternoon, and a doubleheader on Sunday. After the doubleheader on Sunday, you get in a plane to go to the next town, or back home, whichever the case might be. You didn't play again until Tuesday night. And that schedule run like that all year, and it was just so great. You get to a town, you can take your stuff out of a suitcase, hang it up, send out the laundry and get some dry clean or whatever, and relax, and you're there for a week. It's like being on a vacation to play ball. And then every Monday being off, you get back home, and it was great on Sunday afternoon at home, if you had a two-week homestand or a three-week homestand. It's Sunday afternoon, the doubleheader's over, you go home, you cook out, you have a nice time. You know, you haven't got a thing to worry about now until Tuesday night. So you're with your family, you have the kids, and you just have, it was just super. The greatest scheduling that ever was. In fact, there were so many guys that played in the Coast League in those days that refused to go to the big leagues. The minimum salary in the big leagues then was $5,000. And when you're first year in the big leagues, that's all you got. You had to prove that you could play, that you belonged there before they you could ever get off that $5,000 mark. And I don't know that that was true 100%. Probably not. But that was the circumstances. And those guys in the Coast League, there was guys out there making more money than they, than guys making in the big leagues. There was guys in the big leagues making $10,000-$12,000, and they were in the big leagues. And these guys in the Coast League were making $15,000 and $20,000. But it was great, great playing conditions. I mean, if you couldn't play in the Coast League in them days, you could play anywhere.
I mean, who were some of the people in the Coast League with you?
I'm afraid he's going to ask me that. There's just so many guys, and I'm very bad at names.
Well,
I know
who
faces.
Who was your manager then at Sacramento?
Manager at Sacramento was a big rotund fellow named Tommy Heath. And Tommy was just a great guy to play for. And we had some good ball players. We had a shortstop named Rigetti, Leo Rigetti, whose son pitched for the Yankees, Dave. The left hand. That's his Dave. That's his son. And we had we had the Westlake boys, Jimmy Westlake and his brother played there, and when I try to think of somebody's name, Al Heist was our center fielder who later went to Houston when that opened up. Become was a good outfielder, great arm. He had a little trouble with the curveball hitting, but other than that, he was a good ball player. He played center field for us, and. They had Nippy Jones, played first base. Remember Nippy? He's in the Hall of Fame with a famous boot.
The shoe, yeah.
The shoe polish ball in the World Series. And, there's just so many guys. And the guy that ended up managing the Orioles for so long was a pitcher, was the manager of Vancouver. Well, there's two up there. Charlie Metro was one. He was up there. Then this guy was a pitcher for Charlie in those days. And then later on he became the manager of the Orioles for such a long time. Oh, my, I can't think of his name. That's awful. Now, when you leave here, I'll remember.
Yeah. Well, I'm a cheat. Take a look.
But anyway, they were just great, great guys. Oh, there were so many. Ralph Kiner was down at San Diego.
Yeah.
He was a manager, general manager, and also started his broadcasting career there. And I played down there. And I was later traded to Portland. Played up there. Then I went to San Diego and finished up my regular playing days there.
Well, not Paul Richards either.
No. After him.
Well, after him, Hitchcock.
Billy Hitchcock did.
And Hank Bauer was there for several years. And then Earl Weaver took over.
No.
I don't know.
Maybe it was the pitching coach.
Yeah. I don't know. You got me.
No.
So did you stay?
Well, maybe it was in Milwaukee. Gosh, it's hard for me to remember.
Yeah, there's a lot of names, a lot of years.
But anyway, he was a great guy, and he wet him up. He was a stud. He was a cheater. But he was a good guy, and you know. Like I said, I didn't care what they threw. They had, like Hornsby said, you had to throw in the strike zone. And if you couldn't hit the ball in the strike zone, you didn't belong in the big leagues. And that's.
Did you stay in the Coast League down through 63?
Stayed in Sacramento for 2 years. Then went to Portland. Was up there 1 year. Then I went to San Diego, and that was my last year of regular playing. Was at San Diego. Well, I actually didn't play regularly in San Diego. Well, at San Diego, we had a great bunch. We had Suitcase Simpson. Remember the big tall, yeah, and had the guy that later went on to the White Sox at as a pitcher, and I think now he's general manager with somebody. And he was a great athlete, left-handed pitcher. No. But again, it's one of those names that just goes.
But what did you do then after 1963? Did you move back to Atlanta?
Yeah, I came back to Atlanta. I hooked up and scouted for the Houston Colt 45s, and they first were getting started. Gabe Paul was down there, and he called and gave me a job. But I didn't like scouting. They bought a trunk of a suitcase, you know, the trunk of your car. So, and I was away from the family too much. I said, no, I'm going to come back home. So I come back home and piddled around, and then went to work for Lockheed, Georgia company over here. I'm here in Marietta, building airplanes. I went into the employment office and get a job, and they said, well, what do you know about airplanes, Jim? And I said, well, I know how to buy a ticket, and I know how to fasten a seatbelt, and that's about it. They said, great, you're trainable. So we can train you, and you'll be a good worker for us. And they hired me, and they did. They said, you don't have any of these built-in problems that so many mechanics and stuff have, but doing it one way in the aircraft, you have to do it precise, and you have tolerances and all that kind of stuff. So I was in there for less than a year and got into management. I become a supervisor, and I went on the C-130. Then from there, when they first started building the C-140, the C-141, I took a supervisor job and I run that. And then when the C-5 came in, I stayed on that for a while, and then I went to the training department and I trained guys, which I love to do that. Because I'm a people person. I love to be around people and do things. And that was great. I loved it. And then, of course, that began to fade away, and it was coming to the end. I went back up on the line, and I spent 10 years over there. Then after that, I just kind of sitting around one day, and my neighbor said, let's go up and see Colonel Sanders, who was then the sheriff of Cobb County. So I got to go have some business with him if you want to go along. I said, yeah. I met Kermit during his campaign and all. So he came up and right down the hall here, sat in his office. And he asked, Kermit asked him, said, well, what are you doing now, Jim? And I said, well, I'm not really doing anything. I got laid off at Lockheed, and I'm just kind of looking around. He said, well, how would you like to come work for me? And boy, that lit up a ball. I said, well, I guess if you could stand it, I can. He said, well, what do you think about law enforcement? I said, well, I obey the law, and I've always admired police officers, and I know they got a tough job. It's like being an umpire. But that sounds like a pretty good idea. I said, well, wait a minute. So he called personnel, which is on the next floor above us, and got Whit Carson. Whit Carson was the personnel director for the county at that time, 1973. Says, give him the civil service exam. So they brought me back here and locked me in a room. Give me 6 pictures to look at. Had listed these guys, they were all criminals. Their names and height and weight and birthdays and social security number and so on. And what they were charged with and everything. And I studied them for 20 minutes. So pretty soon, here comes this lady come back in. She had a Coca-Cola, said, now, the first 20 questions on this test are going to be about those pictures you were just looking at. Then the rest of the questions, the other 80, was 100 questions, is kind of general questions and has nothing to do with those. But the first 20 will be pertaining to those pictures that you've been studying. I said, okay. She left me the Coke and left. And I started doing those. And I had heard about the civil service exams that if you don't know a question or you're not sure about it or don't guess, leave it blank. Because you're not scored on for the ones that are blank, only the ones that you answer and miss or hit, you know, make get the right answer to. So anyway, I completed all the questions. I'm sitting there wondering, well, this gal's done forgot about me. So I study some of the other questions that I'd left out, and I don't know that, and I'm not writing something in there that I'm not sure about. So anyway, she finally comes back and takes the exam, and I come back down to the office. And Mr. Dobbins, who brought me up here, he was sitting there with him. We were talking there, shooting baseball. Pretty soon the phone rang. He picked it up. And Kermit said, well, how'd he do? You know, he's kind of smiling. He looked at me. He hung the phone up. And you had to know, Kermit was kind of like Hornsby. He'd never give you direct praise about anything, but he would tell you that's the way I like to see you do things. And he tells me, well, you're no damn Einstein, but you passed. When do you want to start? And that's how my law enforcement career started. So I said, well, I'm not doing anything, I can start. And about that time, Jim Lynch, who was the head jailer at that time, come by the door and said, hey, Jim, and I'd known him from serving on grand juries. He said, you coming to work for us? And I said, well, Mr. Sanders here says so, I guess it will. And he said, boy, I need him up in the jail right now. So Colonel said, well, when can you start? Jim said, well, I can start tomorrow, as far as that goes. I'm not doing anything. So Lynch said, boy, that's great. So he said, well, be here at 8 o'clock in the morning. And go to work, right? And back in those days, nobody had uniforms or anything like that. And the guys that served warrants and civil papers always wear a tie and jacket, and most of them wore hats, because that was the old day style was always had a hat. And then, of course, it's modernized now where nobody wears a hat, but we used to in those days. And that's how you told the difference between the guys who were on the road and the guys that worked at the jail, was the guys on the road were suited up with ties and a hat, and the guys in the jail wore blue jeans or shirts, you know, and sweaters and things like that. And when you got on the fourth floor with the prisoners, you couldn't tell the prisoners from the guards, because everybody was dressed about alike. They didn't have, like they do now with the uniforms, you know, the coveralls and the white with the blue striped pants and stuff like that. They didn't have any of that. And it was interesting. And I said, well, I'll start wherever, you know, I can learn to do this business. So from that, I went a year in the jail, and then come out on the road and serve warrants for Kermit. And then, of course, he retired after 20 years of being sheriff here, and Bill Hudson took over. And Bill started organizing. And I stayed on the road, and then I went to pretrial court services and worked over there with Helen Shows for 20 years. I was the apprehension officer for that particular unit. And then when that folded down, Bill brought me back here, and I've been working in criminal investigation ever since. And I'm backup for Neil Warren, who's the colonel, head investigator for our county. And I love it. This kind of work, and people look at me kind of strange when I say that, but this kind of work is a real challenge, because it's something different every day, different people. All these people on these warrants are different individuals, different characters, different problems. Not all of them are public enemy number one by any stretch of the imagination, but they're people with people problems. And you get an opportunity to help them, to in some cases guide them and say, you know, let's get this thing now and get it taken care of, and then go on about your life. This isn't the way to live, to have people out hunting you and wanting to throw you in jail. You know, take care of your business and do whatever you need to do and get straight with the world and go on about your life. Life's too short to be sad and unhappy. And so it's a great challenge, and something you think, it's kind of like baseball. You think you know it all, forget it. You live to be 2 million years old and you never know it all. You'll see something different every day if you're in there looking to learn. And that's one thing that my granddad Greengrass told me. He said, son, that's a little shaver. He told me, to keep your eyes and your ears open and your mouth shut. That's how you learn. Nobody ever learned anything while they were talking. And when you stop to think about that, that's true. Because if you're talking, you're not listening. And if you're not listening, you're not learning.
Well, I think I've got two more questions.
One, fire away.
What have we missed?
I don't know.
That's one question.
I don't know.
We've covered a lot of years and a lot of ground.
Well,
and I've enjoyed every second of it.
I'm 63, so that's 63's worth of green grass you've been listening to.
And the second question, I guess, is, you know what's going on in the area and who is here. Whom else should I be seeking out that could possibly be almost as good an interview as you are?
Oh, I'm sure there's guys that'd be much, much better.
I've got to admit, this is the first time I've done this. And it's a little like a first date. You never know.
Well, I'm glad you started with me.
I am too. I hope they all go this well. I've got about 5 or 6 people I'm planning on speaking with in the next month or so.
Great.
Including two elderly gentlemen. They were both born in 1898.
Oh, boy.
One of them pitched for the 22 senators.
Who is that?
He lives in Homer. You know where Homer
is? Yeah, I know where Homer, Georgia is.
Mr. Lucas Turk.
Luke Turk. Now, see, that name, I knew Turk, but obviously not. Maybe a descendant of his, I don't know, played against a Turk that was a pitcher.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. And, but is back in one of the minor leagues, or he might have been in the big leagues. I don't remember exactly where, but I know that name.
Well, this gentleman pitched for the Washington Senators in 1922, five games.
My, oh my, oh my.
Again, the Society for American Baseball Research has decided that people 90 years and older, we really ought to be zeroing in on.
I said, not going to be around much longer. If you're going to talk to them, you better get at it.
There are two of them in this area, one in Homer, as I said, and the other is a gentleman who lives in Newberry, South Carolina. Henry Levi Johnny, he was known as Johnny Wertz, W-E-R-T-Z.
Now that name, I don't know that
name. He pitched for 4 years for the Boston Braves back in the 20s.
Boy, oh boy. Well, they will be interesting guys to talk to, I guarantee.
Mr. Nixon.
And you can take your time about the guy in the Carolinas, because those people over there live forever anyway.
Do they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, come from Carolinas, you know, you just keep right on going. You don't ever die over there.
And there's a gentleman who lives in Riverdale that people, most everybody I've talked to, didn't know he was still alive. He was the all-star shortstop in the American League in 1941. You know, the year that Williams hit 406?
Oh, yeah.
This is the guy who came in second.
Wow. Who is
Cecil
that?
Travis.
See, I know Cecil Travis well.
Oh.
Yes, sir. I haven't even thought about it. But I see those guys once a year about, and that's at an old-timers picnic we have at the old steel plant down there in Atlanta.
How could an outsider wrangle an invitation? You bring potato salad or something?
That's no, you don't bring anything. I think the barbecue ticket cost you $3, and that's all.
Oh, I'd love that.
And they gather every year, and it's usually somewhere around the 1st of June. You keep in touch with me and let me know. Now, Cecil has been coming. I don't know. There's so many guys and so many amateur ball players and a lot of guys that played Major League Ball. Osborne is down there. Bo Osborne, who played first base for Detroit. You got right here in Marietta, you got Nick Asaski.
Right.
Who's with the Braves. Hopefully he'll be an active player next year, but then nobody knows. I'll tell you a great interview for you. It'll be Willard Nixon. Super guy. Just great. And got some great stuff. And great Ted Williams stories. Sure. Oh, just super. And he and I, of course, we're pals with Ted Williams. And we love him. And he's a great guy. He's good. Williams got a bad rap. But aside from that, the guy will give you the shirt right off his back. He's that kind of a person. And Willard was a great, us old country boy, redneck boy. He used to be a hot, I tell him, he led the league in broken light bulbs in the state. Take that glove and take him out of a game. He'd bust every light bulb in the runway all the way to the dugout. One time he took his uniform off. He took him out of a ball game. He's mad. Oh, he took his uniform off, tore it up in little pieces, piled in the middle of the clubhouse floor, set it on fire. Tough. But see, when the game was over and he got through with all that, country gentleman now, just nice. Look back at that and say, geez, how silly. Well, I led the league when I was at Cincinnati. I'd hit a line drive and somebody catch it. I led the league and kicked water buckets. God, I used to get that. And everybody would clear out of the dugout when I come in it because I'd be so raging mad. But you had to let that frustration out. And once you let it out, I was okay and played that much harder the next time. But that's the way we played. And that's, you know, but he would be, Willard would be very interesting. And he'd give you a different angle because pitchers live in a world.
Differently.
Oh, yeah. They live in a world all their own. Those cats are in another, they're like space cadets, what we'd call it today. You know, they're way up here somewhere. You know, they look at it altogether different than you do as an everyday regular player. And for good reason, because they depend every 4 days to go out there, and that's where they make their money. And they don't get another crack at it for 4 more days. And so that gets kind of nerve-wracking, I would imagine.
You don't do well in an outing, you stew about it for several days.
And then if you get two or three bad ones, you know, you may not be there any longer, and that's all the crack you get. Whereas a regular, you know, he gets at least a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And if he gets a base hit along in there and makes a couple of plays, he can get on and go if he pays attention to business. But they look at it altogether different, you know. Especially if somebody makes an error or something, you know, and the game is in the balance, and you know, they miss a double play or a base hit gets in there that they feel should have been caught, something like that. And sometimes, rightly so, but
What pitcher that you were with or that you saw let that sort of thing bother them the most? In other words, a fumble in the field would just...
Well...
And sometimes a pitcher could recover from that and sometimes they couldn't.
Not too many, but I think the guy that it probably bothered the most that I was aware of was probably Bud Pobelian, who was a pitcher with us in 53 and 4. Gosh, I don't know. Guys were such competitors in those days that there's a lot of difference between being mad at yourself, that you might think they're mad at somebody else, but they're really... Because a lot of those guys would show frustration, but it wasn't toward the guy that made the error or didn't quite get the fly ball or base hit fell in. It was because the fact that they as the pitcher had let this guy hit the ball to start with. So there was it was hard to draw. Guys would blow up. It might have been some younger guys, but for the most part, the guys that I really knew.
If they didn't learn to control it, they didn't stay around. They didn't
blame somebody else for their own problems, because if the guy hit the ball, then it was their problem right off the bat, no matter what happened to it in the field, whether it was caught, because a lot of balls were caught that shouldn't have been caught, or, you know, lucky bounces, whatever.
What was the best pitch game you ever saw?
Well, I never really liked good pitch games, because that meant you're usually going 0-for-4.
Well, it could be somebody on your team, I suppose.
Well, the games I really remember and I was fired up about this one. When I was with the Phillies and Robin Roberts was facing Don Newcomb, boy, two tough battlers out there. And boy, that was it was great just to be in the ballpark with them two guys and those teams. And like the reason I remember it, and I think so much about it, I drove in a winning run for Robbie in one of the opening day games that he beat Nuke in Philadelphia. And but boy, they were tough guys to hit against. And it's going to be 2-1, 1-0, one of them squeakers. And you had to really be on your toes and get that ball and make those plays, because you knew that the game was going to be in the balance. If you didn't do it and you got them get a run, it's going to be hard to get that run back. And it was usually the guy that got, if you got 2 to 3 runs in one of those games, either one of those guys got that much of a lead, got a 2 or 3 run lead on you, forget it. Because it would be tough to beat them. That's not to say that they didn't get beat in those games, because they did. But for the most part, boy, you had to really be on your toes. And those were two great competitors. When guys like that went at one another, it's like Willard Nixon was a great against the Yankees. Jeez, he could put them Yankees, and he'd go against Ford and the guys of that time. Boy, they were exciting games, because there wasn't many runs scored. But you saw the fielding plays. These guys, Rizzuto and those guys, made fielding plays. It was none of this lollipop throwing and all that crap. This was good, hard baseball, and they went over and got that ball, and they fired that sucker, and they run in bases for all there's worth, and if a guy at second base had break up them double plays, the guy had to get out of the way. If he didn't, boy, he's history. He'd be knock him downtown. But that's just the way it was, part of the game. And they were great, great competitive games. There were so many guys. Then we had a guy that Philly always felt sorry for. His name was Jack Myers. Now, Jack had a heart attack and died, and he's in his 30s. Young, good-looking guy. And boy, he could throw that ball. And another good pitcher we had that pitched hard and didn't have any luck. And he got frustrated with the manager more than anything, Jim Owens, big right-hander. Boy, he had the best. In fact, Robbie got him off on alcohol, and he was rooming with Robbie all during spring training 1 year, and Mayo told him that you get him straightened out and he'll pitch the third game and opening the season, we'll give him a chance. And he did, and that Jim Owens, he got off that booze, and he worked hard, and he was ready. And Mayo never gave him that chance. And Robbie never liked Mayo from that day forward. He was swinging there and told him, said, you lied to him. You lied to me, and you lied to that boy. He's waiting every day to get that ball. and you haven't given it to him, as 2 weeks go by and you finally give him the ball, and he's coming to the ballpark every day expecting to pitch. Robbie never got over. Robbie didn't like him at all for that. Mayo was Mayo. And he didn't like Jim for whatever reason, I don't know. But he was a hell raiser one time, and he settled down, and Robbie took him under his wing and was looking at him. Everybody on that ball club was looking for him to do great. And he went out, and of course, when he finally did get the ball, he wasn't really ready to pitch because he'd been waiting, you know, saving himself for that. And it never came. It's pitching is as much an attitude as it is having good stuff, good control in it. So that was tough on Big Jim, but he was a good guy, good ball player. Oh, gee, just so many guys. Hey, my mind churning. I got to get back into this anyway because I'm going down the last of February to St. Pete. They're having the second annual alumni, Major League Baseball alumni meeting down there.
Oh,
and everybody's going to be down there. If you want some interviews, boy, you ought to go down there for that weekend. It's February the 28th, 27th and 28th, and March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd.
Well, mark it down there. I'm sure I've got to work.
But all a fellow would have to do is sit down in the lobby and see these guys go by and say, Mr. Killebrew, could I have a minute of your time? Whoever go by, just so many, K-Line, all those guys are there. And so many guys of less, not the big marquee, as they say today, the marquee players, you know, the Hall of Famers, but guys like myself that played and were proud of the fact that we played and we had a decent career in it. And there's so many of them. Monty Irvin and all those guys are there. And boy, you'd have a field day as far as getting information from major leaguers, and the place is full up. I mean, there's 200-300.
Well, what I'll probably do is I'll probably mention it to the chairman of this oral history committee.
Oh, that'd be the place to go.
The last weekend in February and the first weekend in March?
Yeah, it's the last of February and the first of March.
Okay.
Whatever those days might turn out to be. Yeah. And it's coming up next month, and I'm going down there. And I was there last year for the first one, and it was just so great. I seen guys I hadn't seen in 40 years. We had the best reunion, the best time you ever had, and more bullshit. I mean, talking about old stories and remembering. And that's when you get guys that can feed back to you. I remember when you were here. Remember when you were over here and when we did this and then that. And then it, all of a sudden it lights up. See, all that stuff is in your mind, but it's hard. And it gets harder as you get older. It's hard to bring it back out. And, it's so great. I had 4 days. We had, Catherine and I went together. She can't go this year. She's got to look after her mother, but I had the best day sitting there and talking to those guys and remembering those things, and it's just a ton of stories, just a ton of them. Some great things for what you're doing, for your, you would get so many, and old-timers are there, as well as the newer guys and the Hall of Fame guys are there, and it's super. And they have an old-timer game there. You know, they have the Hall of Famers playing. Oh, yeah, they have two sides, American National League. And all the big marquees, all of them are there. Stands there, a whole bunch.
Well, I will check my calendar, but I'll be awfully surprised if I could get down there. But I'll make sure that somebody knows about it.
That it would be well worth a fellow going down there with a tape recorder and just sitting and taking 15, 20 minutes of the guy's time and say, hey, it's funny thing about ball players, you probably noticed tonight, once they get talking, they don't know enough to shut up, right? And just... But that's so great for me because I don't think about those things. See, I've got a job to do, and I think about what I'm doing. And I haven't thought back into those days and kind of try to dissect them and remember those things. And it's been a great experience for me just sitting here talking about it and remembering because you forgot about a lot of things. God, I forgot about so many things. And there's still tons that I can't get going. But if we had the time and had some pictures. If I was sitting down in my little baseball room,
I'm sure you've got memorabilia and photos.
Oh yeah, I got the pictures and the guys that I knew, and I can tell you about those guys. And of course, you know the names, and just so many great guys. Mel Parnell is another great Boston pitcher and a great guy. In fact, he was supposed to be at the card show, but he was sick.
There.
Well, he was sick. He had the flu bug and he didn't dare to travel. And, oh, just so many guys. Matt Bass was come up last year. And we have a nice thing up in Ringo in first week in May. It's a old-timers game, and about 50 guys from all over the southeast go there. Bob Montag, the great crackerball player, right, will be up there. Bob will be there. He and I are good friends. We play golf, try to play about once a week when the weather permits. And just a great bunch of guys up there, and it's 3 days. We have a golf tournament on Thursday. We have Special Olympics for the kids on Friday with the parade and everything. Then Saturday we play an old-timers game.
In Ringo,
Georgia. And Jack Maddox is the head guy. He's the head of the Catoosa County Athletic Association, or Athletic Department. I guess it's department. He's the county man. And everybody up there knows Jack, and he's a super guy. And now, boy, you get some great story. And you know who comes up there? A guy you want to talk to. You need to talk to him for this. Jim Turner. Remember Jim Turner? Gentleman Jim Turner, the pitcher with the Yankees, and the great pitching coach. And he sat there, and he will talk to you forever. And love every minute of it. You'll just have the greatest kick out of him. He's such a nice man. He's there every year. And hopefully he'll still be with us and be there this year. If he's breathing, he'll be there. And there's a lot of guys come up there. Norm Zouchin, who used to be with the Red Sox when Willard played. He comes, of course, Willard's up there. And, oh, gosh, so many, many guys. Don Budden is up there what's the great announcer? Used to be with the Red Sox, Every time a ball was hit at Budden, he'd say, there goes another base, hit the Budden. Because he was a terrible fielder. Yeah, we kid him about that all the time. The guy lives in Wyoming with a cowboy hat on. He used to do all the broadcasting.
I can't come up with a name.
But Kurt Gowdy. Kurt Gowdy was the announcer when they were done. He said, yeah, there's another base hit to them, but.
Well, I will put that on my calendar.
You'll have a great time. And it's just a short drive up there. And the people are so great. And the guys that come up there, you won't have any trouble getting in. You'll be bring a lot of tape.
Okay.
Can you? And you'll sit in a room, and I'll see that you sit in there with Hurricane Bob Hazel. Bob Hazel had one of the greatest seasons. And trivia question, the last major leaguer, he didn't get credit for it because he didn't have enough times at bat, the last major leaguer to hit over 400, 57 Braves, or 57 Braves. He had the greatest season of anybody that ever, every time he swung that bat, it was a base hit. And he was just mad. That's where he got his name, Hurricane Bob Hazel. Him and you'll hear the stories and laugh till you can't walk. And we just sit in a room and have a bottle of beer, or they'll fix a drink or whatever, drink orange juice, and we just sit around here and talk baseball. And the things that come up and the remembrances and the stories, I tell you, I wish the last 3 years, and I've always thought about it, and every time I get up, get ready, go up there and go, I never take it. It's a tape recorder. I wish I had a tape recorder that would play long enough, because we're talking about hours. We're not talking about a few minutes. And it goes on and on, day and morning, noon and night. And then individually, those guys would be more than happy to talk with you about their career. Hazel, a very terrific and interesting career and likes to talk. The guy, you know, I'd say, well, I love to talk to reporters and guys because, hell, at home I don't get a chance to talk. My wife does all the talking, which isn't true, of course. But I use that as an excuse.
Well, somebody I know once said that enthusiasm is the most beautiful thing in the world, and that's certainly what I've observed.
Well, I'm happy with it, I'll tell you. I loved it.
Well, you did what many people dreamed of doing.
Well, that was my dream, you know. That was when I was 5 years old. I don't think I ever thought, as far as I know and can remember back, I never thought of anything else. I always wanted to play ball, and I was always playing ball, even in the wintertime when snow was 4 foot deep. I was making snowballs and firing them at the trees and making like I was fielding ground ball and throwing them at the lamp posts and whatever. That was just the way I come up as a kid. We didn't have television, and I had one radio. You know, it was a great Joe Louis fan. I listened to every fight of Joe Louis's. But I never had any desire to be a fighter. But I just, I don't know, something about Joe Louis I liked about that man. And I listened to every fight he had.
Did you follow the Yankees when you were growing up?
No, I didn't follow. I didn't even know they existed. Okay. No. No, they were close, and there was a team. You knew New York Yankees and Brooklyn Dodgers because they were always playing the World Series. Uh-huh. And sometimes the Red Sox. And then Cleveland and sneak in every once in a while. And those were the only things you got on the radio. But you go down the main street of Addison when I was a kid in World Series time, and all the store owners in a little street, which is maybe 200 yards long if it was that far. All the shop owners, and they'd have a little stool, and they'd put a radio out on the stool in front of the store, and they'd all be tuned into the World Series. So you could walk down Main Street in Addison, New York, during the World Series and hear the ball game wherever you went. And they were all talking about it, and the guys would gather around and listen, you know, and then they would have their opinion about, well, this guy can't do that, you know, there'd be arguments about who was the best, and it was the big Yankee fans and the Dodger fans, but most everybody was a Yankee fan. In those days, because that's all you ever heard about was the Yankees. I mean, that's what the news media and everybody, the papers, and they always, of course, they were winners. There's the New York Yankees, and then here was the also-rans down here. But I always liked the National League, and I never really followed the American League very closely because I liked the National League. And I guess that comes from always pulling for the underdog, because see, be there, and I got my chance in 1952, and I done the very best I could do as long as it lasted. And I think sometimes the good Lord looks after us too, and he probably saw that here's a kid that has got the desire, and he's got some tools, and I'm going to give him a taste of what he wants to do. But personality wise maybe, and I feel this way sometimes, that maybe the good Lord said, no, Jim can't handle big stardom. And who knows, if I would have went on to head, and I could have played 10 years, 15 years, I was a physical specimen. I had nothing wrong with me except my leg. And, of course, that ended it. But who knows, I might have turned into an alcoholic. They didn't have dope in those days. They didn't know what dope was. But, you know, could have been all sorts of disasters in my life that I couldn't handle that kind of publicity and that kind of prestige and everything that went with that, and I wasn't capable. I didn't have enough knowledge or whatever. I don't know. The good Lord guides us, I feel, anyway. And he might have saw that in me and said, "Hey, this guy's good, and I'm giving him a taste now, and he can make it. And he knows he can make it, and I know I can make it. And I'm not bragging. That's just a fact. I believe that." And so I said, "No, we're not going to let you do that. We're going to cut it short."